Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, and it will probably be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you doing, my friend?
Excellent. Doing great.
All right. Well, we're well into the new year. This is the first show we've done, I think, in about a month and a half that isn't part of a series of shows. Is that right?
That's right.
Actually, last week sort of wasn't. I guess we sort of broke it with PJ last week, although we did talk about the conference, and we were still sort of plugging it a little bit. So that one was
absolutely. Well, but, you know, it's nice to have kind of a freewheeling show, and I believe that's kind of what we're looking at. It gives us a chance to just hit on lots of things.
Yeah,
but we do have a great guest tonight. So
yeah, although it's just the two of us talking, and of course our friend Sally Morham out in the chat room talking with our friends in the chat room, we've also got a very special guest returning to Fast Forward Radio this evening is author and futurist Jim Elvidge. Jim is a Cornell-educated entrepreneur and an inventor. He holds 4 patents in digital signal processing. His love of music inspired him to develop one of the first PC-based digital music samplers and to co-found RadioAmp, which was the first private label online streaming radio company. In recent years, he's turned his attention to the ultimate question of existence and, drawing on a broad and eclectic base of knowledge and interests, has come up with a unique explanation for, well, pretty much everything. Last time he was on, we talked with Jim about his book, The Universe Solved, and this evening I'm sure we'll get into the contents of that book and what's been on your mind lately. Jim, welcome back to Fast Forward Radio.
Thanks very much, Phil and Stephen. It's great to be back on. I remember the last time we were on the show, we talked about all kinds of things. So it was a very interesting show, and I'm sure this one will be too.
Well, we hope so. Now, the first thing I think we should probably get to is, do you correlate any particular outcome with the NFL playoffs to the likelihood that we live in a computer simulation, or does it matter?
Unfortunately, it's not quite that predictable.
I was thinking maybe if the Bengals had gone all the way, that might have said something, but they're already out of it.
Well, you know, the Red Sox did win in 2004, and that was considered to be extremely unlikely, so maybe there's something to it.
Okay. Well, there it is. All right.
The Saints are having a remarkable season, so I guess that's something there, Phil. You know, I mean, you talk about some long-suffering fans.
That's true. Well, I'll tell you, if the Saints win the Super Bowl, it means that the simulation we live in is a very nice simulation, right?
Yeah, that's right.
It's only right that it should come around to them. So that's
a long, long last, yes.
So, Stephen, I think we wanted to start out maybe with some reflections on the movie Avatar, get Jim's take on that. Did you have something you wanted to say or ask about that?
Well, yeah, I noticed an interesting story this week, Avatar Depression Syndrome. Did you catch the story on that?
No, I didn't.
I haven't seen that. Interesting.
Yeah, apparently people coming out of the show are, you know, there's this hyper-realistic, beautiful, beautiful world that you get to experience when you go see that show. And then you walk out of it into our mundane reality, and some people are reporting a feeling of, you know, the blues that last a day or two, or sometimes, you know, if they're particularly susceptible to it, maybe 3 or 4 days. So anyway, I guess we should warn our audience, as beautiful as it is, and as much as we've, you know, said, you know, you really got to go see it, there is that risk. You know, you have to live in this world, so at least for the time being. And so that's well, I guess one risk to seeing something as pretty as Avatar, and as realistic. I think that's part of it. It's not just that it's beautiful. I mean, a painting by Monet would be beautiful, but it's not realistic. This is realistic, and it feels like a real place when you see it. So there's that. So.
It does, and that's kind of one of the things that we are actually hurtling toward, which is the ability to create a realism, a realistic reality, if you will, that is kind of indistinguishable from the other one that we know and love or know and don't love. And James Cameron did that really well with that movie. You get there with your 3D glasses and you get kind of engrossed in the movie and you feel like you're part of the forest and part of that whole scene. And that's a very immersive experience. And that is the kind of thing that we're going to see more and more of. And I've kind of predicted that in probably 20 years' time, we'll be able to create a reality that's virtually indistinguishable from our existing reality.
Well, you know, one of the reasons that Avatar was groundbreaking for a movie is that it was more than just, you know, let's build something in CGI and you know, brick by brick. He actually created within the computer this 3D world, and so the angles that you're seeing the action from are just one potential angle. If he, since every event, you know, is simulated within this computer simulation, if he wanted to, he could go make a director's cut from totally different angles, seeing all the same action. You know, he's got the code, and he's the world is built, so you could see this from a multitude of angles. So, I guess that's part of the, that's, and I believe that this is the first movie that's ever done that.
Well,
yeah.
I was just going to say, you know, every time they make a movie, they're effectively showing you a simulation of reality. But it seems that he's really taken it up a notch. We're a step closer. And I think about this discussion I've had with friends who aren't really into all this accelerating change and simulation hypothesis and so forth, who've said, well, why would I ever want to live in a computer simulation when I've got the actual world and, you know, I can feel and smell and taste and touch and, you know, this vivid experience where things are really happening versus what they perceive would be something more like a, you know, one of these single point of view person shooter games, right? And here, from people getting the blues afterwards, it's telling us that, you know, we're certainly not there yet, but we're starting to head in that direction. Here's a world that can actually get a hold of people and touch their emotions in some way. I think that's very interesting.
Yeah,
sure. Yeah, and I think that I think people yearn for an alternative reality or yearn for some fantasy. I mean, if you look at how many people play video games or even play sort of non-immersive 2D games on Facebook and other social networking applications, it's you know, it's really pretty amazing that that people want to spend that kind of time, and it's because they're looking for an outlet, they're looking for something different. And it reminds me of that experiment that was done some time ago where some electrodes were attached to the pleasure center of the brain of a rat, and the rat was put in a cage and it was given two buttons to press, and one button was food and one button was a stimulation of its pleasure center. And the rats just sat there pressing the button for the pleasure center until they basically starved themselves. So not that humans, you know, have the same mentality as rats, but, you know, the animal instincts are to pursue fantasies and positive experiences. And to the extent that a simulation can do that, I think people are absolutely going to want to pursue that.
Very, very interesting. Well, I can say that although I didn't have the I didn't suffer from the blues afterwards, Stephen. I did write in my review about how compelling I found that, like that first evening that you're, you know, that first night you spend in the forest with our hero in that movie, where you really feel like you're being transported to a completely different place. And having been completely absorbed in books, and Sally's talking about, you know, it doesn't have to be 3D. You can get really caught up in a movie. In the past, you can see how making it even more nearly reality is just going to make the experience all the more, I don't know, Jim, is addictive the right word? Is that the caution, or is that an okay thing that these worlds might actually get an actual hold on us?
Yeah, I think that, like anything, in moderation, it's probably going to be fine, but you know, there will certainly be an addictive nature to it. Experiences like that, books, movies, television even, you know, they run the whole range from being non-immersive to very immersive, and, you know, Avatar is really kind of on the edge of that immersive end of the spectrum. Things like, you've probably been to Disney World or Universal Studios where they have those 4D effects. You watch a 3D movie and then you'll feel the wind blow in your face, or a dog will sneeze on the screen and then they splash a little
right.
water at you
right,
and all
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's sort of done for comedy value, but, you know, imagine that you had that experience. You had the ability to, you know, perceive a reality with your other senses, not just sight and sound, but, you know, also feeling, touching, smelling, you know, even tasting. It doesn't have to be that you have to wear some cumbersome, clumsy headset, you know, with, you know, a bunch of chemicals in there that'll generate smells. It could be something that, for example, you know, to go a little ways into the future, imagine that some nanobot devices were in your bloodstream or able to go into your brain, intercept your sensory signals, and replace them with something. And, you know, theoretically, that's very, very possible, especially given the strides that are going on these days with brain-computer interfaces and nanotechnology. It's just a matter of time before that's possible, and you could inject the reality directly into your consciousness through a technology like that. You don't need to wear a headset. You don't need to go to a movie. It could just all be done, you know, under programmatic control that way.
You know, another thing about Avatar that I would say that they were able to do that I've not seen in a similar movie was they were able to cross the uncanny valley. I really believe they made it with this one. There's no dead eyes on these characters. They're as expressive and believable as you and I, to me. How did you guys feel about it?
Yeah, I think you bring up a really good point I hadn't thought about. And I bet the designers spent a lot of time trying to get, you know, across that valley.
Yeah.
When you first see the Sigourney Weaver character, her avatar, when you first see her as an alien, my initial thought was, oh, wow, she looks just totally appropriate as an alien. It never, you know, there. Think about if they had gone from a actual photograph of her to a computer simulation of her. You would almost have to have that uncanny valley thing. So I guess what I'm saying is, having it be aliens gives you a little advantage in not crossing the uncanny valley, right? We expect aliens to look different from people.
Right.
So, because there weren't any completely computer-simulated human beings in there, were there?
Well, Phil, I'm a little unclear on that, whether, you know, when you're looking at Sigourney Weaver as a human, whether that she was computer-simulated or not.
Okay, if that's a computer simulation, then yeah, they totally crossed it, because I thought I was watching just a regular movie at that point.
Well,
right?
let me ask you a question, Phil. Have you ever seen Sigourney Weaver in person?
Maybe no.
Maybe she doesn't exist.
Wow.
Maybe all of her movies have been a computer-generated.
Well, her movies have been around before they had the technology to do it. So,
no,
yeah, but
they made them
but from here forward.
And they sent them back in time, don't you see?
Megan Fox is probably a simulation, but not
yeah,
sure.
Right.
Angelina Jolie seems very likely to be a simulation, since we're going down this road. All right, so very, very interesting stuff about virtual worlds, but let's talk a little bit about why we're interested in virtual worlds, why this is a topic of interest to us. I'd like to back up just a little bit and talk about, I think we discussed the simulation hypothesis last time you were on. And I'm sorry, it's been a while since I've looked at your book. I can't remember if you reference it directly or not, the Nick Bostrom simulation argument. Okay, so just to recap that argument, here's the standard argument that you hear amongst singularitarians and extropians and transhumanists and so forth. We must be living in a simulation because one of the following three statements must be true. Number one, that almost no civilization will ever reach a technological level capable of producing simulated realities. And since we seem to be on a trajectory that, you know, with Avatar and other things, seems to indicate that that we're almost there, that one seems unlikely to be true. Number two, almost no civilization reaching that technological status will produce a simulated reality for any number of reasons, such as diversion of computational processing power for other tasks, ethical considerations of holding entities captive in simulated realities, et cetera. Okay, so it's like, okay, well, maybe that's it. And then number three, almost all entities with our general set of experiences are living in a simulation. So either nobody ever gets there, or people could get there, civilizations could get there, but choose not to for some reason.
Simulate.
Or, yeah. Or this is one. We're in one. So what's your take, Jim? If you were to lay odds, which of those statements is true?
That we're in one, and I don't know what percentage I'd put it at. I'm certainly not the kind of person who believes 100% in anything, really. But I do feel like there's an awful lot of evidence that supports that. And you know, the way I've understood his argument as well, and I've read a couple versions of it on his website, so I think he's actually modified it to some extent over the years. But you know, in one case, as you mentioned, we consciously make a decision not to pursue virtual reality and these kinds of simulations. And I think we can kind of throw that one out. You know, when have we not pursued cloning or nanotech or atomic energy or anything that has a potential danger? We take those risks, but we pursue them in the name of progress or just, you know, pure interest in where we'll end up. Pursuing that technology. So I really think that that's a very unlikely case. The other one that you commonly see of the three is that civilization will destroy itself typically before it gets there. Now, that's, you know, I think that certainly that's a pessimistic point of view, and nobody wants to think that. But if you also look at it from a logical standpoint, we're about 20 years away from being able to create these simulations. So we've lived, our civilization has lived for, you know, 30,000 years since humans have became symbolic, or, you know, 2 million years since we stood upright. Whatever, wherever you want to start the clock, we've been living for a long time and evolving for a long time. So what are the odds? And we've gone through the Industrial Revolution, which said it was going to destroy the world, and we've gone through atomic energy, where people said we were going to destroy the world, and we started up the Linear Hadron Collider, and nothing happened. And so what are the odds that in the next 20 years something's going to happen that will destroy our civilization? And that seems to be pretty small to me, and it's also kind of, you know, you would have to assume that most every other civilization also encounters that, you know, that narrow window of unlikelihood of progressing any further. So that leaves the third option, which is that we do get to the point where we can create simulations. Therefore, we create them. We create millions of them. And if there are millions of them created by us or by some other entity, what are the odds that we're not living in one right now? And those odds are pretty small. So, you know, his argument is a really, you know, good argument, I think. And I haven't read too many counter arguments to it that make much sense. So it's really kind of hard to discount.
One really interesting take on it actually shows up in a book called The Dilbert Future by Scott Adams. I don't know if you've read that by any chance.
No, but I do know Scott and Dilbert certainly.
Oh, okay. Well, so it's a funny book. It's not actually just a collection of cartoons. He has his thoughts about the future and reality and some pretty wacky out there ideas. But one of his thoughts on the future is what he calls the holodeck fallacy. And in fact, it's kind of a restatement of point two of Bostrom's argument, which is that he says that that a civilization can't invent the holodeck, because if you do, that's the end of civilization. Because essentially, once you have the holodeck, it's your rats, right? Once you have the holodeck, everybody's going to be in the holodeck, blissed out, enjoying, you know, whatever hedonistic pleasures you'd like to imagine, and civilization ceases to exist at that point. So that's not actually an argument against us currently living in a simulation. In fact, it could almost be a restatement of point one, which is that it's not that civilizations don't reach that technological level. It's just that that's actually how they go out of existence. So is there a danger that you know, even out of the kind of humorous Scott Adams take on it, is there a risk for us as a civilization in developing these? Do we put an existential risk on ourselves as a civilization by coming closer and closer to being able to simulate alternate realities?
Sure, and I think it's the same kind of risk that you talk about when you talk about the singularity and you know, technology run amok or gray goo or any of those kinds of things. But you have to keep in mind that if we're living in a simulation, then everything we're experiencing is under programmatic control. So, you know, if the objective of the simulation is for us to really live another, you know, 20 or 50 years in a simulation, then, you know, something would have to happen to you know, prevent any of these, you know, kind of disastrous scenarios from occurring. But, you know, anything can happen. Anything's happened in the simulation. You know, the simulation could end and you could start a new one. You may never know the difference, you know, and the rules may completely change. So it gets to be a little bit mind-bending when you start thinking about using arguments like quantum mechanics or the holodeck fallacy, because those are concepts that we have come up with in this simulation, if we're living in one, if you see what I mean.
Right, yeah. Those are our approximations of, well, actually all of science, I guess, becomes our best guess at re-engineering what it is that we're seeing around us. So in The Universe Solved, tell us about, take us through why anomalies have an important role in your thinking about all this. What's the big deal about coincidences and odd occurrences and the paranormal and so forth?
Sure. There are a lot of different anomalies, both in the sort of metaphysical world as well as in science. So, you know, one example in the scientific realm is there have been some experiments done that show that the human brain seems to reach into the future by a few seconds. It actually seems to anticipate things. So, for example, there was a study done. I think Dean Radin was one of the researchers that put this experiment together. And the way it works is the subject would be shown a series of slides, and one slide was particularly emotion evoking, and they would measure the output of the brain as they were showing the slides. Well, you know, up to 4 seconds before one of these slides was shown, the brain would spike, or, you know, there would be a reaction that would be similar to the kind of reaction had a person seen that slide, a horrible scene or something like that. So, you know, there's an anomaly.
Wow.
That traditional science doesn't want to touch, because it completely upends everything that they've learned and been led to believe. But it's an anomaly that's out there. But it's an anomaly that's perfectly adequately explained by living in a programmed reality. As you can imagine, a computer program can time delay anybody's experience and inject things into that experience at any point in time. And then on the metaphysical side of things, take a Bigfoot sighting, you know, or UFOs or something like that. That, you know, millions of people have seen these things. I've never seen one. I don't know whether they exist. But, you know, even discounting all of the the scientific explanations for them and the military aircraft and things like that, there are still a lot of corroborated cases, you know, amongst, you know, different people seeing the same thing at the same time, that has no explanation that is, you know, that is worldly. So, however, from a programmatic standpoint, a programmed reality standpoint, it's really easy to generate things that people can see that there's no explanation for. You know, imagine a kind of a virtual reality game you're playing, a World of Warcraft or something like that, and the program or whoever is sort of, you know, maybe kind of modeling the program or injecting things into the program, they could put something, you know, into your reality that you experience. It could completely defy the laws of physics that you are subject to, and it could even only be observed by you and not by your neighbor, or it could be observed by a small group of people, or it could follow some rules like, you know, they only show up at 3 o'clock in the morning within 10 miles of a military installation. You know, so these kinds of rules can be, you know, put into a program, and they completely explain almost every anomaly. I mean, virtually every anomaly you can think of, I can think of a way to program it. Now, that doesn't prove that reality is programmed, but it is kind of interesting that the same explanation could exist for, you know, anomalies like coincidences and paranormal things and the feeling of acceleration and something called anomalons, which are observed in scientific laboratories, are particles that are observed by some researchers and not by others under the same measurement circumstances. You know, a lot of people subscribe that to their belief system. You know, that's why the Russians, for example, will see, you know, a certain result of an experiment, but the Americans won't. It's because of their training. But, you know, again, that quantum tunneling, dark matter, cryptozoology, all these things can be explained by a programmed reality model.
You know, Jim, I was thinking that, you know, an argument that I would make against us living in a simulation is that it's not, that our reality is not weirder. That, you know, you and I could sit here and think of any number of ways reality could be stranger. You know, we could have a bunch of superheroes flying around or things like that. I mean, Sally in the chat room saying monsters, dragons, cyclops, you know, all these different things that are not part of our regular experience from day to day. So, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I completely understand what you're saying. And I guess my thought on that is if reality were too strange, if there were too many experiences, if everybody was seeing a UFO every day, then it would be accepted, and there would clearly be a whole new set of laws of physics that would have to be discovered to explain their motion or whatever. By having it more subtle, having these unusual things a little bit more subtle, it keeps things interesting. It keeps the fields of inquiry going. It spawns all kinds of research communities and you know, blogs and social groups and whatnot. And it basically, I mean, it kind of keeps life interesting. If everything were strange, you know, one of two things would happen. Either it would be so strange that people would just kind of freak out, you know, and that I don't understand what's going on day to day. My life is total chaos. You know, and we couldn't live a normal life that way. Or it would be the kind of thing that I mentioned before, where it's, you know, it would require a whole new investigation, a whole new, you know, set of laws of physics to explain.
Okay, I'd like to try this if we could. We've got a piece of data. Let's run it through the let's run it past you, Jim, and let's talk through it and see what this tells us about the likelihood that we live in a simulation. Stephen, I think you had a late breaking news story from today.
Okay, mystery object to whiz by Earth on Wednesday. This is an AP story. Mystery object from space is about to whiz close by the Earth on Wednesday. It won't hurt our planet, but scientists are stumped by what exactly it is. Astronomers say it may be space junk, or it could be a tiny asteroid, too small to cause damage even if it hit. It's about 33 to 50 feet wide at the most. It will buzz us about 7:47 a.m. Eastern time. A missing Earth by about 80,000 miles in the western United States. So it'll be bright enough to be seen with a good amateur telescope. Now, I don't know why they're having trouble identifying it. Why they're stumped as to what exactly it is. If it's moving in a normal fashion, then it's pretty obviously a piece of debris makes it an asteroid of some sort. I'm not exactly sure why they're stumped. But anyway, if it's moving in some weird way, I think they should report that. It's not in this story.
So,
maybe we should go over ways that we would know that it's something unusual.
What does this mystery object tell us depending on what it does? Now, if it were to wink out suddenly, right? We're tracking mystery object, and now mystery object is gone. That is one freaky anomaly. And so that starts to tell us that, there's something odd going on. And, Jim, if I understand your argument, then that kind of plays into a larger picture of, something deeper that needs to be looked at. On the other hand, if the mystery object were to... And I'm just testing this. I'm not sure if this is right or not, but let me see if this is right. If the mystery object were to slow down, land on the White House lawn, the aliens were to get out and say, "Hi, we're here. We're people from another world. We look just like you. We're not really lizards who want to eat you, and we want to be friends," right? Now, if that happens, that doesn't really say anything about this being an anomaly. Is that right? If we discover life on another planet... That's just more interesting science, right? It's the stuff that's out there that never quite gets known one way or another that is tending us towards the universe being a simulation. Is that the idea?
Yeah, exactly. I think you hit the nail on the head. If it's something that we can figure out, it's and my guess is we're going to realize that it's a meteor or something like that. Then that's just par for the course. But if it turns out to be an anomaly, like you mentioned, it winks out, then that's going to fall into that category of unsolved mysteries that there are millions of out there. You just have to barely scratch the surface on the internet, and you find all kinds. And those are the things that are very well explained by the programmed reality model. If it's aliens landing on the White House lawn, then then the program has taken a very interesting and dramatic turn.
Right. Yeah,
no doubt.
It could still be a program, but there's a lot more written into it than we had realized. Okay, great.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
I was going to say there have been a couple of things that have occurred over the last couple of years that do lend some evidence. I mean, one of the things that it seems to be hard to do is to come up with experimental evidence that can prove conclusively one way or another whether we're in a simulation. And when I say seems, because you can program anything pretty much, you can program a whole new set of laws of physics that people respond to, for example, then it would kind of seem that it's impossible to come up with an experiment that will prove conclusively one way or another. I mean, everything almost fits into this model. However, there have been a couple things that have happened that really are kind of interesting. One of them you may have heard about was there's a gravitational wave detector, I think it's called GEO-600 in Germany, that measures gravity waves, which are things that could come from, very distant black hole collisions or something like that.
I'm so glad you're bringing this up, because they're asking about this in the chat room. Are we about to land on the universe being a hologram?
Yeah, well, that is one of the theories.
Go ahead.
What's happened,
sorry to interrupt.
What's happened, no problem. What's happened with this this experiment is that it's really the most sensitive detector in the world, and because of that, It gets plagued by all kinds of noise. I mean, you can have environmental noise or noise in the circuitry that's in the detector equipment itself. But they've ruled out a lot of this, and then there's still left this kind of numerical noise or digital noise that nobody has an explanation for. Well, there's an individual from Fermilab in the U.S., a guy named Craig Hogan, who is the director there. He thinks that possibly what has happened is that that instrument sort of reached the limits of space-time resolution and is proof that we're living in a hologram. Now, it's different than the programmed reality model. There's actually a physics theory that was put forth by Gerard de Hooft, I think. I'm not even sure how to pronounce the name, but there's a physicist from Holland, that says that we're living in a sort of projection, a holographic projection on a higher dimensional space. That is the theory that Craig Hogan is inferring when he measures the noise on this detector. They've done some recent studies that show that the noise is actually a little bit lower than what it should be if that theory were correct. And to be honest, I haven't read enough detail about it to tell whether it's true. And I know that they also plan to do a more high frequency. They want to tune the detectors for higher frequencies, and if they do that and the noise level stays the same and looks the same, then it's another indication that it very well might be something like the limits of space-time. But my thought is more about, thinking on the graininess of space. You don't have to have a holographic projection to have that. If you look close enough to your computer monitor, you'll see the graininess. If you look into the code of a computer game, you'll find that every object is modeled to a certain resolution, and it has to be, because if it were infinite resolution, it would take up infinite disk space and infinite memory, and it would take infinitely long to load into the system, and it would be infinitely expensive. So, creating a reality or creating a simulation or creating a game is all about really economic trade-offs. Physicists do tell us that our reality is digitized. They tell us that time chunks along in 10 to the minus 43rd seconds. They refer to as a jiffy, the Planck unit of time, and that space is a grid of distances separated by 10 to the minus 35th meters, way, way, way smaller than the size of atoms and things like this. And this is inferred from, basically quantum mechanics and quantum mechanics experiments and things like that. But if that's the case, if our reality really is grainy like that, things are locked into that grid effectively, and all time is the sequence of events that change the states in those grids, then that performs exactly the way a computational mechanism does. Computer clocks along at 10 billion cycles per second. It has resolution that in space, and it has resolution in time, and absolutely nothing happens in between those clock cycles in a computer. Just like physicists say, nothing happens in between the jiffy cycles in quantum mechanics. So, they're already telling us that we're structured that way, that our reality is structured that way, and you have to wonder why. What's the purpose of being quantized versus continuous, and the only thing I can think of is that argument of, it's a trade-off. It's a economical trade-off, and why would economics come into play in the, creation of our universe unless it was being created by somebody else programmatically?
Somebody who only had so much power and so many resources to work with. They could only render this. To them, I guess, somewhat crude, kind of coarse. I mean, very elegantly done, very nicely done. I'm not to diss anybody's work here.
Not putting down our reality here.
But struck by lightning, Phil. Sorry.
Well, not to get lightning straight in the spleen or anything like that. But as I read it, the theory that this is a projection from a from a two-dimensional universe, we would actually have we would be more coarse than the real particles in the real universe that we're a projection of by a factor of 19 orders of magnitude, right? So, I mean, we're talking about, you know, we're just this big pixelated mess, right, compared to whatever level of reality would have produced us. Now, you really start getting a headache when you think, yeah, but what if that level is also a simulation?
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. And that's the thing that's kind of interesting here. You know, my first thought when thinking about quantum mechanics as evidence for a programmed reality was, well, what kind of computational machine could create a reality at that resolution? If you take Moore's law, which is the law that says technology advances at an accelerating pace, every couple of years, you double the number of transistors on a chip, you double the speed of your processors, and all that kind of thing. Moore's law has been going on pretty solidly at the same exponential pace for the last 40 years. If it were to project 200 more years, we would hit that machine that could create a quantum a reality that is described by quantum physics. So 200 years isn't really that long in the cosmological time scale. I mean, you know, we talk about finding different planetary systems or different solar systems around some of the new stars that are being discovered that are billions of years apart. So 200 years is insignificant compared to that. It's certainly conceivable that some civilization has created a computational device that can create a simulation that is at high resolution as our reality seems to be. That being said, again, we're in the reality. So that's kind of assuming that this computational device has to run at that speed. It's also possible that it could be a lot coarser, as you say. We can't peer any deeper than the size of the atom these days. And the size of the atom is, what, I don't know, it's probably 20 orders of magnitude different from the Planck length. I think a neutron is 10 to the minus 15th meters. The Planck length is 10 to the minus 35th. So there's a lot of room to play there. You know, our reality could be five orders of magnitude below atomic scales, and yet these quantum mechanic effects that we see that we've inferred the Planck length from could just be in the program, if you know what I mean. And so that noise that's found in an experiment like GEO-600, it's perfectly acceptable to me that noise could show that we have a graininess in the, you know, 10 to minus 23rd meter size, or 10 to minus 27th, or 10 to minus 35th. It could be anything, really. Again, the programmed reality model supports almost any level of graininess.
So how about this for a question? Kind of taking it back to Stephen's point about why the world isn't stranger than it is. Let's take the question the other way. Why isn't the world more normal than it is? I suppose that the standard scientific explanation for any kind of coincidence or anomaly is just that there will always be outliers. And in fact, I've read about coincidence before, that the argument is that there's just so many events occurring that a few weird ones have to occur because that's
right.
Just the nature of the nature of the number of events that occur. But just supposing for a moment that the universe is a simulation, why would the designer want to put clues in? Wouldn't you want, I mean, it seems equally likely that they would want to create a universe where you could never figure out that it was a simulation, that would not be a detectable thing. Or am I imagining a level of design perfection that's not achievable? Is it an accident or a mistake, or is it something that they've deliberately put in there so that we would figure it out? And if so, it would appear that it was predicated on us reaching a certain level of scientific acumen and a certain level of technological development before we were able to put it all together.
Well, I mean, you ask a really good question, and we could kind of head in a few directions on this. I mean, one might be that if the anomalies weren't put there, it might not draw us in that direction. So let's imagine that that you're a creator of a reality, and you have a bunch of people who are playing a virtual reality game online, a massively multiplayer online role-playing game of some sort. And you realize that, and as the, say, owner of this company that creates this software, you watch the number of subscribers and the number of simultaneous users, and you see that, gee, over some period of time, it's starting to tail off, and people are starting to lose interest, and they're going to the next big thing, maybe. You might start injecting some things into their reality to get their interest back. I'm not saying that that's what's going on, and you know, one of the other directions we can go with this line of argument is just the fact that you ask that question kind of, what's the word, when you ascribe human characteristics to something non-human.
Anthropomorphized.
Yeah, it kind of anthropomorphizes the creator of the reality, kind of assuming that they think the way we do. You know, that's maybe a counter argument to this whole thing, because it does seem like they think that we do the way we do because they are putting anomalies into the reality that draw us in that direction. But maybe it's so that we evolve. Maybe it's so that we can discover things and you know, get to a certain point where we can discover a truth or something. I don't know. You know, some people have speculated that if we're living in a programmed reality, and this is the Bostrom argument, that we created it ourselves, we created it in our future, and so why would we create such a mundane life where we have to take out the garbage and do our laundry? You know, questions like that. But that also assumes that, you know, we are creating this reality in our future, and, you know, why wouldn't we do something a little more significant? There's a whole lot of directions you can go on that, too, one of which is our reality doesn't have to last that long. We think we've been, you know, living this thing for 10 years, 100 years, 1,000 years, don't know. But theoretically, your memory can be erased, your memory can be replaced with something else, and an entire scenario with multiple players can be rebooted at any time. This gets to be a little bit wild in thought, and a lot of people will say, oh, that's just insane. But the more you think about it, the more you realize we're not even that far away from that capability. Maybe this, the here and now that we're in, doesn't really last that long in real terms. And there is some reason for us to live it the way it is. We just can't understand it. And again, maybe we can't understand it because the designer of the reality is so far out there compared to the way we think that we would just have no idea what the motivations are. I speculate a little bit on that in the book. The purpose of the book is really more about presenting the categories of evidence than it is about kind of speculating who does it, when did it start, and all that kind of thing. But that's really, you know, more of an interesting topic maybe for another book.
Well, yeah, I'd like to see more on that. Although I think you make an excellent point, which is that there's a natural tendency, once we start talking about the universe being a designed place, to think about people like ourselves sitting down at our keyboards and drawing something up in, you know, Visio, and then, you know, rendering the nice picture, you know, and then slowly creating a simulation for whatever reason. I don't even know why we do them now, you know, much less why would being capable of creating this level of simulation do it. But I think that's a really good point. The anomalies may be completely beside the point to somebody who would design that. They might not be thinking about that at all and have no interest in that. And that it's interesting to me would not even be of interest to that designer. So I think that that kind of puts you back in your place, I guess, when you look at it from that standpoint. Well, I've got two other things I want to get to, but before I dominate all the rest of the time, Stephen, anything else for Jim or anything from the chat room that you've seen?
Well, I thought something interesting that Sally said was, well, we're in a simulation. To heck with morality. It's all a game. And Sally was saying that tongue firmly planted in cheek. I happen to know or have visited with Sally on a couple of several occasions, and she's about as far from being a nihilistic as you can get. But it does the thought experiment that that we're living in a virtual simulation. Does that have anything to say about ethics?
I don't think it does, and the reason I say that is just because you know, ethics has to do with your deep-seated beliefs, and if we are playing this simulation, then we, you know, our souls are somewhere else, you know, and those souls have that those same deep-seated beliefs, whether they're living in a real reality or whether they're playing a simulation. If you were to know that you were playing a simulation, and maybe this is the reason that you are not let to know, but if you were to know that you were playing a simulation, you might feel like, oh, I can get away with some things that I couldn't before, which would run counter to your beliefs. But if you're suppressing those things because you're worried about consequences, well, what's the difference between the consequences in a real world and the consequences in the simulated world? You still feel pain. You still, you know, experience negative experiences one way or the other. So I really don't see too much of a difference there, and I don't see that this idea says too much about ethics. Another way to look at it, too, is, it's often thought of as a, you know, kind of a projection into your mind, but another way to look at the possibility that we're in a programmed reality is to think of our whole physical space as being under program control. That one's even a little more out there because, and your former guest Jay Storrs Hall talks about the kinds of things like utility fogs that can, you know, in the future, be composed of, say, swarms of nanobots that can, under programmatic control, create a sofa or create a room or create a complete environment. And when you talk about those kind of macroscopic things that can be done, you know, and again, nanotechnology experts will put this maybe 50 years out. When you talk about those kind of things that can be done, they usually refer to these kind of macroscopic objects that I mentioned. Well, that's just an order of magnitude different in scale than, say, a house or a neighborhood or a city or a country or a globe or a universe. And again, there's Moore's Law saying maybe it's possible at some point through molecular assemblers to actually create realities, physical realities, like the one that we're living in now. And so that's a different way to look at this whole thing, but it could follow the same rules.
Okay, so real quick, I've got two things for you. One is we can't let you go this evening without giving you props for your Michael Jackson prediction. Tell us about that.
Oh, sure. Well, it was a funny thing. Somebody had posted something on our forum last year at the beginning of 2009, just asking for people to put out some predictions. So I put out four things that just popped into my head, and one of them was that the LHC wouldn't discover a Higgs boson, and I forget what the other two were, but one of them was that Michael Jackson would have a comeback tour and it would fail miserably, which is the way I put it. And you know, I fully expected, I don't know why I thought that, I just kind of thought, you know, this is somebody who we haven't heard from for a while, and it's probably time for him to do a tour, but I just don't think it's going to go over well. That was my rationale behind putting that down there. So when he died, it was really kind of very kind of creepy, you know, in terms of the prediction, and you know, a lot of people on the website were kind of shocked at the whole thing.
Well, if that's not proof that we're living in a simulation, I don't know what is. So are you going to make that? Are you going to make four big predictions for 2010, or have you already? And
I'm thinking maybe of quitting while I'm ahead. I still don't think the Higgs boson is going to be discovered, but I don't have anything beyond that right now.
I'll tell you, the Michael Jackson thing is impressive. The Higgs boson thing is impressive. What would have really put you over the top, I think, if you had told about the, if you had predicted the bird and the baguette preventing the collider from coming online, I think we'd pretty much all have joined your cult at that point. You could you could write your own ticket if you made that one. Now we're just about out of time, but real quick, I was just reading about quantum suicide/quantum immortality. In a minute, tell us how that relates to the world you describe in The Universe Solved.
You know, I actually haven't thought about how it relates to it. I mean, the idea of quantum suicide is it takes that Everett interpretation of quantum mechanics and the Schrodinger's cat scenario, and basically says the following, that every instant that a decision is made, a quantum mechanical decision is made, a new universe is created. Well, if you are playing sort of atomic Russian roulette with the suicide capsule like Schrodinger's cat is, then as an observer, you are going to observe, you can only observe the universe that's created that you're in. So theoretically, every time that atom decays and, you know, you have a 50-50 chance of dying, you end up in the reality where you live, and you will actually never die. So it's a little bit of a paradox in that sense. And one of the kind of interesting speculations that I read was that perhaps the whole Linear Hadron Collider thing was a quantum suicide experiment that was, you know, being conducted in real time with our world. So the LHC is creating these, these black holes that destroy the Earth, but the conscious entities are observing the one where it doesn't, which is the reality where the LHC fails. So they keep dropping, pieces of bread into it and whatever else it takes to keep it from generating these black holes.
Wow. Well, it's interesting. The TV show 6 Feet Under actually toyed with that a little bit. One of the characters, one of the central characters, died, and we got to visit his near-death experience. And in his near-death experience, we're seeing all these different versions of his life. And at some point, somebody explains to him. They say, "You know, you always wake up in a universe where you're still alive, or a reality." Right. They might not have said universe. So it could be that that the simulation is just we're here to learn a lesson, and we're going to learn it whether we want to be alive or not. It's just going to keep sending us back in like a twilight zone or something like that, maybe.
Right. There is actually a lot that the simulation argument can talk about parallel realities. Just from a very crude level, virtual reality games, multiplayer online games, are run on different servers, and those different servers have different users and different they may start with the same construct, and they all evolve into something differently as people interact with their environment. Normally, you can't jump between them, but there's really no reason why a character on one server can't jump to another server. So that might be how, we may be able to jump from one parallel reality to another.
Okay, well, listen, you get to work on that next book. Because we're
let you know who did it, right?
Yeah, we're eager to read that. And if you have some thoughts on how we get that jumping from one level of reality to another, get that in there too, because we'd like to hear more about that. Well, it's great having you back on. Thanks for being with us. Hope you have a great year. If you decide to make some predictions, let us know what those are, and let's be sure and have you back on again very soon.
Will do. Thanks very much, Phil and Stephen. It was really a pleasure talking to you guys.
Thank you, Jim.
All right, Stephen, what do we got going music-wise this evening?
Okay, the band is Anubis Spire. Anubis Spire is the band, and the song is "Underneath the Roswell Sun."
"Underneath the Roswell Sun" by Anubis Spire.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Okay, looking forward to listening to that. Thanks for getting that together, Stephen. Thank you, Jim Elvidge. Thanks, Sally, and everyone in the chat room. Everyone listening live, all who are part of Fast Forward Radio, thanks for being with us. We look forward to being with you again next week, and until then, live to see it.
The Army Air Corps today announced the recovery of a crashed flying disc from a ranch near Roswell, New Mexico.